I'm going to try to stand the whole time, but I've been given permission that if I can't stand, I can have a seat. So I'm going to sit right behind this podium so you can't see my face if I sit. My name is Heather, and I am an alcoholic. First, I want to thank you guys for inviting me out and inviting me into your home and asking for a little bit of experience, strength, and hope for me. So I'm humbled and grateful to be here. Just to start off, my sobriety date is October 5th of 2010. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor who has a sponsor. And actually, many of you probably know my sponsor. It's Cindy Kay. And she wanted me to pass along hellos to everyone here. She couldn't make it tonight. So now you guys can say I did what she asked me to do. I still follow directions sometimes. And my home group is the First Tradition Group in Stanton. We meet on Friday nights at 8 o'clock, and we have a meeting also on Tuesday nights at 8 o'clock. I'm trying to think of anything else I need to throw out there. I think that's it. So I guess I'll start just, I give a little bit of background about kind of where I came from, a little bit about my parents, and not to tell their story, but I think it's a good introduction to where I came from and kind of my upbringing a little bit. My mom was fairly young when she had me. She was 20, and she had suffered a lot of abuse and lived in an alcoholic home growing up herself. And my grandfather drank a lot and was very abusive to my grandmother on that side. And it ran, alcoholism definitely ran in the genes. I remember my mom saying that she had a grandma named Tootsie that was married like 6 or 7 times to a couple different gangsters and used to hide her alcohol bottles in the toilet tank and in the garage and spare tires in different places. So I come by this honestly, I think. my father also was definitely a user and abuser of substances. He had pulled a couple prison sentences before I came along, one for in particular for manslaughter. He had beaten a man to death in a blackout. And so my mom and dad definitely, I think, were two injured people, both mentally and spiritually, and probably physically too. And so it's by none of their fault that I am the way that I am, but I think that their upbringing kind of influenced the environment in which I was brought into this world. And so my parents they got married when my mom was pregnant with me, and shortly after I was born, I guess I was about 2 and a half, and my dad was drunk and high at a party and was stabbed to death. So I grew up without a father. My mom had been married a couple times after my dad's death. And so I don't remember a lot of stability or consistency. I think she did the best that she could with what she knew and what she had. I remember some vivid memories of being young and watching abuse from my stepfather to my mom. I remember he got up for work really early in the mornings, and I remember standing in the shadows of the hallway and watching arguments, and that often became physical. And so my role model for a man and what a father figure should be was pretty poor. I think I learned a lot from my mom on how to be a strong woman, but I think that there were times that the message that she meant to send wasn't always the message that got delivered. And so there was a lot, like I said, there was a lot of inconsistency for me in my childhood. I remember I'm very controlling. I'm still extremely controlling with everything and anything that's around me, and I will control you whether or not you want me to. So that's definitely a defect of character, which I know is on that list of defects, and I'm aware of it, and I'll probably touch on that later too. But I remember being young, and my mom would say too that I was very controlling with my toys, even, and forceful with toys and how I played. And I was blessed when she had a baby, and I had a little brother that was like a living doll that I could control and manipulate. And my brother and I are 4 years apart, and my mom kept drinking. Even after I was born, I can honestly say I don't remember too many times where my mom actually was under the influence. I don't remember like big parties at the house. I never walked in and saw my mom with a needle in her arm or a straw in her nose. I don't have any memories of that, but I do have memories of hangovers, lots of different people in and out of the house. So I remember the effects of it, and I think at that time when I was little, I wouldn't say that it was effective of alcoholism. I probably would just say that that was just normal life. That's just what I knew, and I thought that my life was pretty normal until one day I realized that my life wasn't normal. It was different. My mom got sober when I was 10. She took me out to a restaurant, and I think she had a Time magazine in the magazine there was an article about codependency, and she told me she was going to go to this program for 2 weeks while I was at school, and she'd be gone from like 8 to 5, and she'd be home every night, and so the neighbors were going to keep an eye on me and my brother when we got home from school, and I don't remember a lot about it. I really remember that exchange with her, and I think it was like the second or third day that she was there. I got a phone call after school, and she told me I needed to go get the neighbor's mom because she wasn't coming home for 28 days, and that was pretty traumatic at 10 years old. I remember being extremely angry, and it didn't make sense. It was confusing. She didn't come home for 28 days. And I remember my brother and I would go to visit her on the weekends, and we'd get these little plastic cups that kind of looked like a shape of a pudding cup, but there was apple juice in it. And we'd go outside and we'd go and we'd visit her, and she seemed really peaceful and different and like, oh, the world is so great. And that was so different from what I knew. She got out of treatment, and I started going to AA with her, and I was one of those kids sitting off in the corner with my coloring books and whatever while you guys all introduced yourself as alcoholic, and I thought, man, there's a lot of those people, at 10 years old, when she got sober, I thought that was the worst thing that could possibly happen, and in part, too, because my life had changed. My mom seemed pretty absent for a while, and I will say it's kind of hard for me to do this sometimes when I talk a little bit about the childhood because my mom is in the room, and I would not cry, so it's kind of hard because I don't want her to think that I don't appreciate her or love her. I remember before she stopped drinking and, she would drop me off at my aunt's house, and I remember, I'll pick you up tomorrow morning at 10, and she wouldn't show up for a couple days. And I remember being told that we would do something and then it wouldn't happen. And, I remember lots of broken promises. And she wasn't there a lot. I remember taking care of my brother, and part of that was just because I was controlling, because like I said, he was like my baby doll. And the other part was that I felt the need to be more of the parent. So, I did those things for him. And when she got sober, that stopped. Like, she was the mom. And my most hated phrase she ever said was, Heather, I'm the parent, you're the child. So she took back her role as a parent. And that, like, rocked my world. That was different for me. So she was now a mom. And that was a big change for me. And my mom did a lot of things right. You know, I was in sports from a very young age, and I did very well in sports and in school. So I found that that's where I really thrived. I played softball and other sports, but softball was definitely my passion. And I still play, hence the crutch and the giant fat ankle. And I'm not as quick as I used to be, because I was quick, but the ball was quicker, so it hit my ankle. Now it's swollen. So there were some changes that happened for me. So my mom did a really good job with getting me involved in doing things. And as she started to get into AA and go to meetings. She had a sponsor, and I remember her name, and I remember going places and sitting in meetings, and I remember her first New Year's sober. We went to a New Year's dance, and we danced, and I remember, thank you, I remember stuff like that, and AA was a really neat thing for me at that age. I really liked it. I grew up in St. Louis, and they have their annual state or some big convention called the Fall Classic at this big hotel every year. And I remember my mom would be in meetings and stuff, and I'd be running the hallways and playing and having fun with kids. And I started going to Al-Anon, so I was about 11 or 12, and I had this little briefcase that I would carry to meetings, and I chaired Al-Anon meetings. And I had a sponsor, I can't remember her name, but she was like 80 years old, and her husband had like 40 years sober, and she had been in Al-Anon for 40 years. And I had my books and my meditations, and I did all that, you know. I'm grateful for it, but it almost seemed like when it was time for me to actually come into AA as not just a spectator, but as a member, it was a little difficult for me. You know, and as I grew up and got into high school, I was never really a popular kid. Wasn't popular much at all, and I didn't hang out. I kind of tried to hang out with the jocks because I was one, but I never really fit in because I wasn't that cool, and I wasn't nerdy enough or geeky enough to fit in with the geeks, and I wasn't that pretty or popular and skinny, so I couldn't hang out with the pretty popular skinny girls, and so I just kind of floated from group to group, and I didn't party much my first year or two in high school. I don't even think I got invited to a single party my first year or two, and I think I always felt uncomfortable in my own skin. I think it's important for me to say, I think the first thing that I remember putting into my body that changed the way I thought and felt was food. I used to steal my brother's candy, and my mom would make him a plate of food, and he wouldn't want to eat it, and so she'd leave the room, so I'd eat it off his plate. I used to ride my bike up the street to the 7-Eleven into the grocery store, and I'd go in and I'd steal a 12-pack of ice cream sandwiches from the bathroom, and I'd put them in my pants and up my shirt and in my bra, and I'd ride my bike home eating them as fast as I could, because it was different. It felt fun. It was risky, but it also gave me some satisfaction, and it felt like it was filling a void. And so I remember my first drink. I think I was just about 16, and I went to a girlfriend's 16th birthday party, and I heard a speaker say, I should say this too, I probably should start out, if I say anything that's profound or makes a lot of sense, it's probably because I heard it from someone else. I am not that original. So I heard a speaker once say, you know, when he was in a cornfield, I think, and him and his buddies were drinking the first time, I think they were drinking bourbon, and he said, "What alcohol did to me that first time did the same exact thing to me as it did for everybody else I was drinking with, and that was got me drunk. But what it did for me was something different than it did to the people I was drinking with." And that really relates to me. You know, I think I probably drank six Budweiser beers at this party, and it was a buzz for me. And I remember I fell down my girlfriend's staircase at her house and sprained my ankle, and she's like, "Do you know that you fell down my stairs?" And, "Oh my God, you were so embarrassing." And I was like, "I never want to do that again." And then I did it again and again and again. And but it felt different. I felt all of those things that's written in the big book in that first chapter about I have arrived, and I finally felt a sense of comfort and peace. And too bad that those feelings didn't stay. If it was just those feelings I experienced, I would probably still be drinking. But unfortunately, there were a lot more negative experiences that happened, and it didn't make it worth it anymore towards the end. So I dabbled a little here and there, and my story includes some drugs, and so I dabbled in drugs and did that too. And I think my first real serious negative consequence from drinking was my mom, in her first couple years of sobriety, met a man that was also sober, and they later married, and they're still married. And my mom has 21 years today, and my dad, I think, my mom will have 21 years this November, and I think my dad just celebrated 19 years in June. And so they were sober family. We were sober kids. My stepdad's mom died, I think, with 26 years sober also. So I knew that drinking and doing drugs was wrong, and I knew that I had a really good shot at this thing not working out well for me, but I was different, and I was going to prove everybody wrong. And I can tell you that I think almost every single time I drank with a purpose, and my purpose was to prove that I wasn't like my parents and that I could do it successfully. And so I was about 17. My parents were on a trip, and I was staying with my youth minister and his wife, and I had a bottle of tequila in a bag and in my overnight bag. I had this big bottle of Jose Cuervo and a bag of weed, and that's what I did. And I did it all. And then I did everybody else's drugs, too, and I ended up overdosing at 17. And I remember my mom called, I think, the next day to check in on me, and the youth minister's wife had to say, well, we spent most of the night in the emergency room because your daughter overdosed on drugs and alcohol. And my mom got on the phone, and she said, I really hope you enjoyed that, because when I get back, your life is going to change. So you better enjoy the next couple days since I'm out of the country. And she came back into town and put me in the same rehab that she had gone to, like 7 years before. I did outpatient. There were some pretty big consequences for me with softball. I was benched for 2 weeks. They wanted to kick me off. My mom wanted me to be kicked off the team because I signed a contract that says if you use drugs or alcohol, you can't play sports at the school. And they were like, well, no, she's too good. We need her. So we're just going to tell her don't do it anymore. And I was going to keep playing. Well, my mom, being the good AA-er and having, 12 steps, she's like, there's consequences for behavior. You need to. So I ended up getting suspended for a couple weeks and I couldn't play, but I had to dress and sit on the bench and watch my team play without me, which was a big deal for me then. And we moved shortly after I graduated high school here to Virginia, and I thought it was going to be a great big start, for me, that I could reinvent myself and I could be anybody that I wanted to be. And I remember being young and always being, I'm a big believer in the fact that if you say always, never, that it's not true, because nothing is always or never. So in my head, I always remember hearing that I was too big, talk too much, too loud, too much of things. I remember being told I was too much of those things. And so when I moved here to Virginia, my goal was to be quiet and soft and popular. that lasted for like a day. And I ended up going off to college with a guarantee of a softball scholarship as long as my grades were good and I showed up. And there were two spots on the team, and all I had to do was show up. Show up and try out, and it was mine. And it was a Division I school. It was a pretty big deal for me. And I remember going to college, and everybody seemed like such stuck-up snobs, and there was a girl at the end of the hall, and she wore her makeup kind of exaggerated, and she was kind of dark, and I heard her playing that rap music, and I thought, oh, I'm going to like her. And within a week of starting college, I was drinking pretty heavily and doing drugs, and I went to go to the softball tryout and pulled up to the field, and there were about 60 girls trying out for two spots, and I knew that all I had to do was show up, and it was mine. And I told my girlfriend, I don't want to go. I just want to go get drunk. So I left and went and got drunk. I never went back. I got caught with drugs and alcohol on campus, and they called me into the dean's office, and they said, you've got two options. Option number one is you can withdraw and go home quietly, or we're going to expel you. And I said, okay. How long do I have to think about this? And they're like, now. I'm like, oh, okay. So my mom called, and she's like, why don't you go ahead and come home for the weekend? So I went home for the weekend, and my face was kind of sunk in, dark eyes, circles. She could tell something was up, so they had a family meeting and had an intervention, said they were going to go ahead and pull me out of school because they knew I was drinking, and they were going to help me. And I said, okay, you can pull me out. So I came home from school, and I went to another treatment center, outpatient treatment, and it took me almost two years of being sober that time before I finally admitted to my parents that I'd gotten kicked out. They didn't do me any favors because I had been kicked out of school. So I came home and I got a job, and my parents said, you got 30 days to make up your mind if you want to live here and be sober or you need to get out. So I started going to an outpatient treatment and got a job and lived at home and managed to get 2.5 years sober. And then I was going to meetings, and that was my life. I went to NA and AA, and I worked and lived at home and had a good relationship with my family, and things were good. I will say that in that time, I changed sponsors 14 times in 2 years. And I did 14 steps 1, 2, and 3 never to do a four, and had a good job, and was looking at going to school, and somehow through the grace of God, I got another offer to go to school, and I got a full ride scholarship to VCU to be a forensic chemist, and was ready to go off to school. I knew it was all ready and all set, and I decided a blind date sounded like a good idea. So I went on a blind date at a bar and met a guy at the end of the bar that was cute and drunk, and I fell in love. And 2 months later, I was pregnant. And so couldn't go off to school. I not only was he drunk at the end of the bar, it only took me about 2 weeks, and I was drunk at the end of the bar with him. And so I drank for 6 weeks, and in that 6 weeks, I got pregnant. And I turned 21 on a Monday, found out I was pregnant on a Thursday, and drug my ass back to a meeting on Friday and went in there, and I said, all right, so I've been out on maneuvers for 6 weeks, and now I'm pregnant, and I don't want to have this baby, and I definitely don't want to have this baby drunk. So I got sober, and I stayed sober for almost 5 years. I ended up marrying my son's father, and which I think I married to try to fix a pretty bad situation anyways, and it didn't work. And when I got sober that time, like I said, I was sober 4.5 years, and in those 4.5 years, I got married, had a baby, got divorced, bought a house, went back to school and earned my 4-year degree, working full time, going to school full time, and my son went back and forth between his dad and I, and things were working. Life was pretty good. And in those 4.5 years, I switched sponsors 9 times, never to do a 4-step, and I did steps 1, 2, and 3 over and over and over, and again drank. And I remember that time when I started drinking again. I try to spare you guys the gruesome details. I'm sure you pretty, I would assume that all of you know what a hangover is, and that you all know what dry heaves are in the morning and needing to take a drink the next morning to calm your stomach down, and what glassed over eyes look like, and I should have bought stock in Visine because that was my number one friend. So I try to spare you guys those details, but that was pretty much in there. That time I started drinking, I had like 4.5 years sober, and I was hanging out with some girls from the gym, because I was going to the gym all the time, and they all drank, and I was always the designated driver. You know, I was about 25, 26, and I wanted to have fun, and going out to bars and listening to bands and having guys flirt with me, and I enjoyed it, but I was envious of everybody else that could drink, because I wanted to drink, you know, what's that saying, with impunity, like in the big book. I wanted to have that, and I was getting pissed, and that's the bottom line. I was sick and tired of always being the designated driver. I was sick and tired of watching them get their buzz and the giggles, and damn it, I wanted that. So I also started breaking my own rules. I never allowed alcohol in my home. My friends drank, that was fine, but you couldn't bring it in my house, and so towards the end of that sobriety stint, I started letting people bring alcohol into my home. And it was the night before Thanksgiving, and I had 3 beers left in my refrigerator from a couple days before when some buddies had come over and watched football. And I was supposed to be the DD again that night. And I went into my refrigerator, got the 3 beers, took them into the bathroom, cracked the top, and watched in the mirror as I drank each one. And I guzzled them. And I wanted to get it in me, and I sat there, and I looked in the mirror, and I was waiting for a change. I was waiting for it and waiting for it and waiting for it, and nothing changed. And I thought, I got this. And I got extremely, extremely intoxicated that night and blacked out just like that. It didn't take long. And with those 3 beers, I was off to the races for 4 years. And about 4 or 5 months after I started drinking again, I asked my ex-husband to take custody of my son. I'm going to cry again. So I kept drinking, and my son became an inconvenience. And this is all really raw, because I just went to court Thursday for custody, so it's kind of raw. But he was an inconvenience and not a priority. My priority was how much can I drink, how much can I use, how much can I take, how much can I get. Whose attention can I get? What man can I take home tonight? What's going to make me feel better? And my 4-year-old didn't do any of those things for me. And so over the next couple of years, I really thought I had it together. I really thought I had it together. And so I would at first it started with drinking on the weekends, and then it went to weekends and Thursdays, and then it went to weekends, Wednesdays and Thursdays, and then eventually it was Monday through the weekend. And all the times that I'd come into AA before, and I knew AA, I can recite the book to you, I can tell you anything you want to know, I can tell you what page to go to, I can quote it probably forwards and backwards, I can tell you what year it was found, I can tell you where it was found, I can tell you all of that stuff. And so this time around in my sobriety, that line in there where it says knowledge alone will not keep a man sober, that's a big deal for me, because my knowledge didn't keep me sober. And so I thought I had it all together, and I tried to convince my parents and my family and everybody around me that I got this. It's fine. It's not a problem. And so all the times I had tried to get sober before, when I was drinking before, I had never, in my head, I had never really had any negative consequences. I didn't think that an overdose was a negative consequence, and I didn't think losing a college scholarship was a consequence, and I didn't think losing another scholarship was a consequence. So I always said to myself that I had never lost a job, which wasn't true because I lost 9 in like 1 year, but in my head I thought I had never lost a job. So I'd never lost a job, never lost a husband, never lost a house, never been to jail. The courts didn't take my child from me. So I thought I had it all together. And so this time around, when I started drinking again, that's how I gauged success. As long as there were no negative consequences, then I was drinking successfully. In 2008, I had my first run-in with the law, and I got a DUI in Northern Virginia. I was driving up there because I had an interview the next morning with a state agency, and I was pretty much assured for the job. It was my third interview, and they were going to offer me the job. And I went up the night before to hang out with some friends, and I got lost on 66 and turned around, and I think I was lost because I was drunk. Probably the truth, but I ended up getting lost on 66 and dropping my cell phone, so I bent down to pick up my cell phone and ran smack into the back of a parked car on the shoulder at 10 o'clock at night. And my first thought was, who the parks a car on the shoulder of a highway at 10 o'clock at night? Not like, who drives drunk in the shoulder at 10 o'clock at night, but so I hit this guy, and the first thing I did was grab all my beer bottles and throw them in the trunk. Then the gentleman gets out of his car and walks around to the passenger side and pulled his 8-year-old son out of the car to make sure he was okay. And I went up to him and I said, I'm really sorry, I didn't even see you there. And he's like, no, I'm sorry too. My son's really sick and he's been throwing up, so I pulled over because he's throwing up in a cup. And I'm sorry. I'm like, me too. And I exchanged information. I called my buddy and I said, I just wrecked my car, come get me. He's like, okay, I'm coming. I'm like a mile up the road. And so I do the information, I do the exchange, and I'm like, cool, State Farm, they'll pay for everything, have a great life. And I go to jump in my friend's car, and here come blue lights. And so I was that close to getting away, and in my mind I thought, what? I couldn't believe that state trooper was doing his job. Like, how dare you drive down the highway? And it wasn't the fact that I broke the law. I was mad at the cop for doing his job. And anyway, the officer asked me if I'd been drinking, and I was like, I quit drinking like 6 hours ago. And so he asked me to do all the roadside tests, and I passed them. And he's like, well, my breathalyzer in my car's broke, so I'm going to need to take you downtown to breathalyze you. And I'm like, whatever, and I didn't care. And I got there, and I blew a .22. And so that just kind of tells you a little bit about that. I could function pretty good at a pretty high amount of alcohol. And the judge, a couple months later, ended up sending me to jail for my first DUI. So I pulled 3 weeks in Northern Virginia in a jail, and I do not do well in jail ever. That in most cases, most circumstances, that that may be enough to get a normal person to stop drinking, and or at least to stop drinking and driving, but it didn't for me, and I kept going, and that was the first thing I had done that gave my ex-husband enough power to take me to court. So he took me to court, and I also lost custody of my son that year, and kept drinking, and I would try to get sober, and it wouldn't work, and I knew where to go, and I knew where you guys were, and I knew what I had to do. I just wasn't done, and I wasn't ready to let you guys tell me what I needed to do to change my life. I was going to keep doing it the way I was doing it because I knew more than you, and my ego is pretty big, and it absolutely bothered me that I'd be sitting in a room with people that were sober and happy, and they didn't have high school educations or college degrees, and some didn't have teeth, and some didn't have hair, and some didn't have driver's license, and it was absolutely embarrassing for me to be seen with you guys, and that's what I saw and where I didn't want to be. And that next year, I ended up losing about 9 jobs in a year. And none of them were, you're drunk, so you can't work here. It was, you're showing up late, or you have an attitude, or whatever the reason was. I was combative, and I fought anyone and everyone. And it was never my fault. It was always yours. You know, I kept drinking, and I was in and out of relationships, and I said the other day to someone that, you know, I'm in a relationship now, and it's been about 6 months, and in the scheme of my life, and the big picture, 6 months is probably just a blink of an eye, but that is a really long time for me. Most of my relationships lasted between 6 hours and 6 days, so for me to be with one man and no one else, and to be honest and open and respectful, most of the time, to him is something new to me. That's not in my normal conduct. And so, anyway, long and the short of it was, is I was able to maintain on the surface for the most part. I was a good employee when I decided to show up for work, and I had a really good job for a while. And I had to supplement my drinking with something because it's slightly inappropriate to carry around a koozie with a Bud Light in it at work. So I started using pills a lot to try to supplement that for me. And towards the end, I had wrecked 2 more cars. In 6 months before I got sober, I had wrecked 2 more cars because I kept drinking and driving, thinking that I was just absolutely invisible. And I had gone back a couple of times to get custody of my son. The court actually even awarded me a temporary 50-50 custody schedule as long as there was no alcohol. And my ex-husband caught me driving under the influence with my son in the car. And I thought that even today, like, my mind goes, man, why? How could that not be enough to make me stop? And I kept drinking, and I just didn't care. And I ended up going to work one morning, and it was a Monday morning, and I'd been drinking for like 72 hours straight, and I knew I reeked of it. My eyes were glassy, and I walked into the chaplain at my work. I worked in a homeless shelter, and I walked into the chaplain, and I said, so here's the deal. I just breathalyzed myself, and I just blew a .17 at 10:30 on a Monday morning, and you're either going to help me get into rehab today, or I'm going to resign, and I'm going to go home and drink myself to death. So those are your options. And this woman had 24 years sober, and she looked at me, and she goes, wow, you think a lot of yourself, don't you? And I said, well, you know that I am good at my job. She goes, you haven't been good at your job for a couple months, Heather. And I said, well, are you getting me to rehab? Like, nothing could get through to my head that I had a slight ego problem. And so she had a bed reserved for me at a rehab center a couple hours from my home within an hour. And I went home, packed my stuff. She had offered to take me, and I said, no, I can get there on my own. And so I called one of my best friends because I knew she'd show up with what I wanted. And she showed up with beer and Xanax and every other pill under the sun and drove me 3 hours from my house, and I drank all the way there and ended up acting like an idiot in a Walmart and cussing out a lady and telling her what she could do to herself, to her mother, to her kids, because she wouldn't sell me any more alcohol. And I did it all in front of an off-duty police officer who called his buddy, who was on duty. And my girlfriend got a DUI and I got arrested for a drunk in public 6 blocks from a rehab. And I went to jail that night, and they actually were going to take me to the rehab until I started punching and kicking cops and dented a cop car door, and they arrested me and took me to jail. And my memory of that night is very spotted. I have a couple moments that I remember, but it's very hazy and fuzzy for me. But what I do remember, I remember that I had rubbed my arms and my hands raw, that there were blisters, and because I had rubbed and rubbed, and my voice was really strained from screaming. And they end up putting me in a restraint chair, and in Virginia you can only be held in a restraint chair for 4 hours, and then they have to let you out. And I remember being in this restraint chair screaming and screaming and screaming, and this woman came to the window and she said, "Heather, you got to stop screaming before we let you out." And I said, "I know the law, and I know that if I peel myself that you have to let me out of this chair, because you can't keep me in this chair if I'm covered in my own urine." And she said, "Well, Heather, go right ahead and do what you feel you need to do." And I said, "Okay." And I sat there and peed on myself. And she came in and they got me out of the chair and changed my clothes and then put me back in the chair. So I did it again, and they got me out of the chair and put me back in the chair, and I did it again. And they put me in the chair because I was banging my head on a metal toilet as hard as I could because I wanted the pain to stop. And I had no one to call. I didn't have anyone to call on the other end of the phone that would even answer the phone for me. I was probably too drunk to remember any phone numbers anyways, because in today's society, my cell phone does all my thinking, so I didn't even know anybody's phone numbers. And at that point, you know, both my sober parents had told me about a year before that they didn't want a relationship with me, because they couldn't watch me kill myself any longer. And I hadn't talked to my parents in a year, and I think I called them the day I went to rehab, but it's really fuzzy, so I don't remember. And that, I think, was the lowest that I have ever been. And that pain of being so alone and feeling so broken and knowing that I had no one to blame but myself. And I thought in that moment that I was so unworthy of anything. And the chaplain, she later called and found out that I was in the jail, and she called and she told me the story later, that she called and she's like, "Why has she not been released? Why is she, you know, I hold drunk in public for 6 or 8 hours and let you go." And the woman on the other end of the phone says, "I'm not sure, can you hear that screaming?" And she's like, "Yes." And she goes, "Well, that is her, and she is through 4 double-plated glass doors, and you can still hear her. So until she calms down, we will not let her go." And eventually I calmed down, and I went to rehab, and I spent, I think, about 16 days there, because that's all my insurance would cover. And I came home from rehab, and I went back to the same meetings where I had been for years. And I walked in, and I said, "I am back, and I am broken, and I need help." And so I looked around the room and for the next week or two looking for a sponsor. And I remember seeing Cindy in a meeting, and I remember thinking, "Man, she looks boring." And she looks boring, and she's got a boring life, and she's probably never been anywhere. She's probably never done anything. And she's probably exactly what I need, because I think my life needs a little bit of boring. And so I asked her if she'd be my sponsor, and she said, "I have to check with mine." And she went to her sponsor, who at the time I did not know who she was, but I later found out that I did know her. And Cindy says to her, "You know, there's this young girl named Heather," you know, she didn't say my name. She said, "There's a young girl, she wants me to be her sponsor." And she said, "I just don't think I have the time for her." And one said, "Well, what's her name?" And Cindy says, "Heather." And she goes, "Oh, yeah, you got to work with her. You don't have a choice." And she said, She said, I know you probably don't believe me, and probably what you heard or seen of her in the last couple weeks, is you probably wouldn't believe me if I told you, but I promise you're going to learn more from that young woman than probably anyone you've ever sponsored. And so Cindy called me back, and she said, just so you know, I don't want to do this, but my sponsor says I have to. So, yes, I will sponsor you, and you will be at my house at Tuesday at 6 o'clock, and you will have your big book, and you will call me, and you will blah, blah, blah. And I thought, ooh, bad choice, Heather, bad choice. And, you know, I started working with her, and I will say that, you know, she is not boring at all. And she successfully helped me walk through my first 4 step, and I did it in its entirety, and I didn't die. And I didn't kill anybody either in the process. You know, she helped me learn what I thought I knew about AA, and it's one of those things, I think, when you can read something and go, oh, that makes sense, but then you live it and you apply it and it changes. So, you know, I guess October will be 2 years for me, and in this 2 years, I lost a job sober. I got out of rehab and lost my job because I couldn't follow directions and rules. And even sober, I still made bad choices. And I lived on people's couches for a couple months because I didn't have a place to stay. And right after I got out of rehab, I was put on supervised visitation only with my son. And then through my process of these last 2 years, you know, I'm now back at the point where I get my son, I get him overnight, and no one has to watch me with him. And it's not ideal yet. It's not where I want it. You know, I just went to court on Thursday, and I thought I was going to get what I wanted, and it wasn't exactly what I wanted. And someone told me today that it wasn't a loss, but this is just an opportunity for me to do something better and different. I will say, though, that for me, one of the biggest things that I think I struggled with a lot was the concept of God. I know in the 12 and 12, it talks about that there's the different types of people in their relationships with God, that, you know, there's the people that are raised with a strict religion, and then there's the people that have no concept of God, and then those ones that have a God when they're young and grow up, and then they walk away from that God to come back and find a God. Those are the ones that struggle sometimes the most, and you know, that was me. My mom did a great thing and put me in private education my whole life, so I was kind of force-fed a God, and so when I got that opportunity to rebuke it, I did. And so coming back and finding a God that would find me worth loving, and that would be protective and loving and kind and gentle with me, was a hard concept for me to grasp. And I still have moments where I doubt, and I'm not sure what this God is supposed to do or look like or be like. And then I realize that that's just me trying to make something out of nothing. I am definitely not one that, my God does not speak to me with burning bushes or anything like that. My God is pretty quiet most of the time. And when I am quiet, which is one of the hardest things for me because I am a talker, when I am quiet, my God will reveal himself to me when I'm ready and only when I'm ready. My relationship with my parents has mended. You know, they definitely had to tell me. You know, they knew that I needed AA long before I probably did. They probably knew I needed AA when I was 8, or that at some point I would qualify for this program. But you know, they had told me towards the end of my drinking that they couldn't have anything to do with me because I wasn't safe and it wasn't healthy for them. And When I got 6 months sober, they told me that they'd be willing to communicate with me. And I thought that was going to be a really long, hard road, and I thought that it was going to take a lot of therapy or anything like that. And the first time I saw my parents in a year and a half, it was probably the best thing that could have ever happened, was to have my parents back. And not just because they're my parents, so they have to love me, or that they have to be around me, but because they chose to be around me. Because I'm someone that's, I think most of the time, pretty neat to be around. You know, there were a lot of things that that I did when I was drinking and using that I regret, and there are scars that I've probably left on my son. But Someone told me today that what I am doing by being sober every day and by asking the courts to consider allowing him to spend more time with me and putting up that fight, even when there's days where I think I did not get sober for this, that is my way of making amends. You know, that I am swinging that bat, and I'm going to keep swinging it until my son is with me. And, you know, for a long time I went to the ball game, but I wasn't participating in it, and I sure didn't have a bat to swing. So today I have that bat to swing, and I'm doing it. And sometimes I miss, and sometimes I don't. So I think one of the neatest things is for my son is to be able to say that he wants to spend time with his mom. And when asked why, he says, well, she doesn't get dizzy anymore. And to a 9-year-old, that speaks volumes, I think. I say a lot back in my area, and when we talk about behavior and we talk about God, I talk about how my standard of conduct has changed. When I was drinking, I had a lot of conduct and no standards. And there were, you know, what I thought was acceptable behavior then is definitely not acceptable behavior today. It has changed. And today, and I am by no means perfect. I have a lot of growth to do. And I pray that I never stop trying to grow and get better. But I know that today I operate with a moral compass, and I have a higher standards of what I think is acceptable behavior and how I want to speak to another human being and how I want to act and what kind of woman I want to be and what kind of daughter and mother and employee and partner. And I said the other day in a meeting about spirituality that I think spirituality exists in every one of us, but for me it was absolutely... I did not have the ability to be a spiritual person when I was living the way that I was living. They didn't exist. My behavior would not allow a power bigger than myself to participate in that life. And so today, my behavior is different, and there is room for a power that's bigger than myself because I act accordingly. One of my favorite lines in the big book is... I don't think it's still probably the same in no matter what edition, but on the bottom of page 14 where it says, if a man fails to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through, self-sacrifice and work with others, he will not survive the highs and lows yet to come. And, you know, today I find that I am capable of helping another alcoholic. I'm capable of giving of myself without expecting anything in return. And so that's kind of where I'm at, and I'm grateful for the people around me that have watched me bounce in and out for years and say, wow, something's kind of changed. You know, maybe she's got it this time. You know, and for me, like... A lot of people come into AA, I think, and they've got this image that they created for themselves out in the bar and out in those social circles, and so they have that image to overcome what they created for themselves. And for me, unfortunately, I not only had the image at the bar, but I had the image in AA because I had bounced in and out so long that people are like, yep, she'll be gone. Yep, she'll go back out. And I don't think a lot of people had much faith that I could do this. So now instead of drinking with a purpose, I attend AA with a purpose. Like my purpose is to show I can do this and I can one day at a time not take a drink. I'm really grateful for the latest version of the big book. For a long time I would read those stories and they were so foreign to me. I could not relate to a Southern Baptist preacher. I could not relate to the floozy in the bar that had been married 9 times. I just couldn't relate to those stories. And finally, there's a story in the big book about a woman whose dad was in AA, and she used to be that kid sitting in the corner at the table. And when she was ready, her dad was there with a big book. And when I was ready this time, my parents were there with the big book. And so my story is finally in the big book. And so that relatability factor was a big deal for me. I would just, I guess, end with... I definitely want to end this. I remember a sponsor that I had a long time ago, and her name is Rachel, and I used to tell her that I had a lot going on. I always seemed to have drama, especially when I was younger, probably all the time. Who am I lying? I have drama in my life a lot, and I have a tendency to create it myself. And I remember saying to her one time, she's like, "You'll get through this, you'll get through this." And I was like, "I just want to be there. I just want to get through it and be there." And she said, "Heather, if I could pick you up from where you are right now and this pain and suffering and put you there, I would do it. But unfortunately, you wouldn't know how to act if I picked you up from here to there, because you haven't learned all the lessons in between that are going to make you a complete woman to allow you to be successful there." And so my goal today is not to get from here to there, but to travel from here to there and learn those lessons in between. And, I'm grateful for AA. I am grateful for sober, loving parents. I'm grateful for a son that today is a priority to me, that is not an inconvenience. I have a great job, and I'm spoken of very highly in my job and by my supervisors and other agencies I deal with. And I've gotten a lot back in these two really short years of sobriety, which some people it takes a long time to get it back. And for some reason, it's coming back together for me pretty quickly. And so I'm trying to remain level-headed and remember how quickly I can lose it, because I've lost it before. And I'm really grateful for AA and my parents and an amazing sponsor. And I appreciate the opportunity to come out. And I'm not sure if that was what you hoped for or what your expectations were, but my foot's starting to throb, so I'm going to sit down, and I thank you all for asking me to speak.